Welcome and Touch and Talk. This is a space that is held by Touchney and friends. We are a group of invested people who are trying to follow the events all around the war in Ukraine and trying to support our Ukrainian friends through the spreading of truth and precise information. That being said, we're very glad. Well, I'm very glad. I don't want to speak for everyone, but I, for one, I'm very glad to be sharing the mic with my friend Monkey, who. Oh, here you are, Mr. Monkey. Can you give me a Putin Julio, if you can hear me?
Putin Julio.
Great. So, for those of you who were not there, Mr. Fresh Monkey is gracing us once more with his presence. He was already there. When was it? Well, it was 3 weeks ago. To talk about dry bulk in particular and shipping in the Black Sea in general. I, for one, learned a lot, so I begged him to come back, and for reasons that are known to himself, he decided to come back, and well, we're very glad, and we'd like to thank him. How do you do?
I am very good. I'm very happy to be back. I know I wasn't your first choice, but you know, sometimes you just have to do with the best of the rest, right?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, the freight elephants and freight seals were busy. So, no, what can I tell you? That being said, so a very quick summary of what we learned the last time. A lot of our discussion was about the what the normal looks like. So we talked about Ukrainian exports of dry bulk, and there we went back to the basics. So we talked about what has been shipped, where to, following which regulations, and we learned in particular that Ukraine was exporting a lot of grain, which most of us knew already, but also that a number of other commodities were being exported, including steel and coal. So what I would love to for this time is to go a little bit deeper into the generality, and then I'll get to ask you, so maybe talking about this for 15-20 minutes, and then I'll get to ask you the truly interesting question, which is, what is happening in your eyes? How are you reacting to it? And Fred Monkey, what I really like is the fact that you care about this not only out of interest, like many of us as a citizen of the world, but also because you're an investor, and that brings a special type of interest into this, not interest, but a special point of view in this sort of questions. So, without further ado, never mind. So, one thing I learned while I was reading tweets is that there are different types of ships, some big ones, some small ones, and I also think that the ship that carries, for instance, wheat are not good to carry coal. So, can you give us a rough understanding of what sort of ships are trailing, are sailing across the Black Sea?
Yeah, absolutely. So, if you look at the Black Sea, because of some of the geographical limitations, you don't tend to have the very largest of the ships. They're not there in great numbers. Tends to be more the small to medium sized bulker. A huge part of the fleet is what you would call coasters. Or short sea ships. They generally have a capacity of up to a few thousand tons of carbon carrying capacity or dead weight. So when you see a lot of these images, they're quite small ships, you know, 2 to 3 to 4 thousand tons of dead weight. And we go all the way up to quite large sizes, but in less volume. But I would say that the bulk of the grains that are exported, the bulk of the wheat and the corn, is exported on ships larger than 40,000 tons of dead weight, generally in what we call the Handymax or the Supramax or the Panamax size of ship, which roughly speaking goes between, say, 45 and 85,000 tons of dead weight. And these ships can load up to, call it, 70,000 tons of corn. So, you know, they're quite big ships. It's not entirely accurate that ships that are good to carry coal are not good to carry grains. But it's true that the more dirty cargoes you carry, the more difficult it is to get your ship into a clean condition to do foodstuffs. So ships do tend to specialize somewhat. That said, the smaller you go down the chain, the more flexible the ships are, as you can probably imagine. Very small ships, 2 to 3,000 tons of dead weight, can very easily clean up to do certain bulk cargoes, although they'll also specialize in all kinds of other stuff. When you look at the small sizes of ships, they can carry anything from tractors to coal, to grains, etc. And as you get bigger, you have to really specialize in certain bulk commodities because it's more difficult to achieve stability requirements, etc. There's an app that you could use for free, which is called Marine Traffic, and you can kind of have a look at you know, which ships are in the Black Sea, and you can press on them and get a certain amount of information for free. Not everything is for free, otherwise you need to pay a subscription, but you can have a look and you'll see that there's all kinds of different sizes of ships and combinations, etc.
Fantastic. You mentioned 17,000 tons. Just for a general understanding, how big would the largest ship be?
So the largest grain ships that do grain business en masse, because, I mean, theoretically you could do it with some of the largest ships in the world, but the largest size that is commonly used for grains is the Panamax, Kamsarmax size, which goes up to, call it, 85,000 tons of dead weight. They're about 230 meters long, the LOA, that is, and they're 32.23 meters wide, which is why they're called the Panamaxes, so that they can fit in the locks of the Panama Canal, and the max size that can go through the Panama Canal. So these are big, big beasts. When they're fully laden, they have over 14 meters of draft, which means that below the water level, you've got 14 meters of ship. So you can imagine that the size of that. If you don't live close to the sea and to a maritime choke point, you probably have never seen those kind of sizes of ships. But if you go on a Mediterranean cruise or so, you might pass by one of those. Sort of a workhorse of the industry. They're quite flexible to do all types of cargoes, from grains to coal to iron ore to petcoke to really whatever you need to put on there. But maybe a little bit too large to do specialized stuff like transporting agricultural goods. For that, you would use, machinery, excuse me. For that, you would typically use maybe smaller ships. And there are big developments in that front on the Black Sea that I think we'll touch on that in a little bit.
Hopefully. Just for my general understanding, there's a ship that is been doing the rounds recently, which has a very special feature. It has a hole where no hole used to be. It's a Russian ship. As an example, how big is that ship?
I think you were mentioning the Sig, which is a Russian flagged. I think we could call her a coastal tanker. She's actually a very small ship. And she's not exactly a civilian ship because she's on charter to the Russian military, if I'm not mistaken. And she's been doing the rounds between the Black Sea and Tartus in Syria to supply the Russian Air Force with jet fuel in order for the Russian Air Force in Syria to conveniently bomb civilians. So that is actually a very small ship. I know that there were some tweets around saying that it was a large ship, which is not the case. As a point of comparison, 3,000 tons of dead weight will probably load something like 2,000 something tons of cargo, which is not small amounts by you know our normal human standards. If you're filling up your car, you're maybe putting 50 liters inside. This is 2,500 tons, but compared to what oil terminals export on Aframaxes or Suezmaxes, which call in the Black Sea, a Suezmax will go up to 120,000 tons of dead weight and will load about 1 million barrels of oil, which is, call it, 100,000 tons of oil. So very small ship by shipping standards, but still a significant local player, because these small ships are necessary to go into small ports and to lift small cargoes that go over shorter distances. It's obviously something we've talked about a lot in the past few days. Although that activity has somewhat calmed down, it feels like both on the Ukrainian and the Russian side there is a bit of a hiatus on naval activity, maybe because on the Russian side they've understood that the Ukrainians will respond to tit for tat. If the Russians go and bomb a port, well, the Ukrainians can blow a hole in our tanker. It seems that there are some negotiations in the corridors of power between the Turks, the Ukrainians, and the Russians to maybe reignite some kind of great deal. And until then, some of that more spicy activity that we've seen last week has calmed down.
Okay, very good. The last one we talked, you and me privately, we mentioned the port of Novorossiysk, and you said a few interesting things about it. I was wondering if you could be so kind as to repeat that, especially regarding the fact that while this port is important, it is not the only one that matters in the region.
Yeah, so from the Russian side, Novorossiysk is probably the most important strategic port for them. On one hand, because it's a dual facility for cargoes, civilian cargoes, but also for military ships. Russia only really has a few good ports for their military. One is obviously Sevastopol that occupied Crimea, although Sevastopol is not a very important harbor for commercial shipping. The other one is Novorossiysk. They've also been building up a lot of capacity in a place called Taman, which if you go and have a look at the Crimean Peninsula and the Kerch Bridge, you will see there's a city or maybe a town called Taman. But if you go towards the south where Volna is, there is the port of Taman, which has become a very large export facility for not only coal, but also I think they're starting to do grains. But also liquid products. If we differentiate the bulk with the liquid products, the bulk is obviously stuff like grain, and the liquid products is stuff like oil, or even vegetable oil, and refined products from crude, such as jet fuel, diesel. That's another important place. Kafkaz is the third very important spot for Russian exports. It's also past the Kerch Bridge. Maybe just Google it because it's a little bit more difficult to explain, but it's in the Taman Bay area. Then finally, if you go inside of the Azov Sea, one extremely important choke point and cargo area for the Russians is the area of Rostov-on-Don, and you'll see on marine traffic the amount of ships that come in and out of Rostov. One reason why Rostov is so important is because it is connected via a system of canals and rivers all the way to the Caspian Sea, but also going north into the center of Russia and even all the way to the Baltic. So this is the sort of response that Russia has to the American navigable waterway of the Mississippi. Russia also has its own version. It's nowhere near as good. It's nowhere near as large, but it is very important for them to keep the flow of goods moving north, south, east, west, etc.
Okay, so it's their Grand Canal,
but it's south.
Yeah, and it was made by labor, but so that's quite interesting. So I was wondering if, let's say, the Ukrainians manage to, I don't know, you close an harbor, maybe you sink a ship in the at the mouth of the harbor or something like this, or just sailing becomes too dangerous. The Russians still have the opportunity to sail from the Baltic Sea, albeit, you know, less efficiently, but closing the Black Sea would not close Russia to business.
Well, okay, it wouldn't close Russia to business, but if you look at a map of where the grain is loaded, where the grain is grown in Russia, the sort of northern part of the Caucasus is incredibly important for Russia. All this Krasnodar, sort of, you know, between Russia, between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea, and then sort of hugging the northern end of Kazakhstan. That is where all the grain, all the wheat is grown in Russia. Despite being a very, you know, humongous country by square mileage, Russia in general has quite poor capacity to grow food. They only make up in sheer size, but the prime farmland for Russia is essentially historically it's been Ukraine, which is why Russia always wanted control of Ukraine, but also this area of Krasnodar and on the edges of Kazakhstan. A big part of the rest of Russia is not really a very good agricultural land. And it sounds a bit strange to people because they do have lots of rivers and lots of water. And all you need for wheat really to grow well is enough sunshine, which you should have in Russia, at least in the southern end. So sunshine, relatively clement summers, and irrigation capacity, which is essentially of water, which is why historically wheat has grown in places like the Levant and Egypt, and not really northern Germany, which is cloudy and wet all summer. But the problem is Russia's soil isn't very good, and most of Russia's rivers flow actually northwards instead of southwards, and this is something that escapes most people when they think about navigable waterways. If you have a river that flows northwards into an ice sea, what happens in winter is the river freezes from the mouth on the way up, which creates an environment where rivers basically get blocked, a bit like if your pipe is blocked and you have water returning, sewage water returning, because it's blocked at the mouth. The same thing happens on Russian rivers. So essentially, areas of Siberia are either swamps in summer full of mosquitoes and other insects, or they're basically desert, and you don't really have much of a in-between, which condemns a lot of Russia to be basically not very useful agricultural land. That's to put it in short. So Western and Southern Russia is very important. And, you know, getting all this grain to the Baltic would be very difficult, probably impossible, but also repurposing the ports in the Baltic would be practically impossible the Baltic ports were built, were designed and built around, of course, military facilities. I mean, St. Petersburg is important for that, but also for exports, but mostly around smaller quantities of agricultural products, but mostly around coal and iron ore, which is closer to where those commodities are mined. So if you look at the port of Vistost, for instance, it's not at all, that's the port in the Baltic, it's not at all, let's say, ready to export grains. And the other problem with the Baltic is if you have a very cold winter, most of the ports freeze up. If they freeze up, then you need to have icebreakers. And if you have to have icebreakers, then you need to have specialized ships that can go to those places, because most normal ships are not strengthened for ice. So if essentially they hit what we call pack ice, which is thick pieces of ice in the water, they will it will damage the hull and create create big issues for the ship owner. So the Baltic is not a viable solution for volume. It's of course a niche solution, but not a viable solution for volume. The other one is the White Sea through the White Sea Canal, which the Russians famously built on the back of, you mentioned it, slave labor. Probably hundreds of thousands of prisoners died building that canal. But the problem with the White Sea is, again, ice is an issue, although you are actually better protected than in some other places. But in general, the capacity is not so large because the facilities aren't so big. So for Russia, even though you wouldn't close off their trade, you would severely hamper them if you made the Black Sea untradeable for Russia, which is why keeping control of the Black Sea has been Russia's strategy. And of course, if you look at things from a larger geopolitical point of view, this has always been a fight between the Russians and the Turks. And the Turks are kind of happily sitting back and seeing Russian power erode because they want to be the sort of masters of the Black Sea. So if you want to look things in a more philosophical and grand scale geopolitical point of view, it's an interesting fight that's happening at the moment.
Well, fantastic. Thank you. Thanks a lot for this answer. Just one thing pops in my mind, and I'm sorry if the question is completely stupid, but Georgia also has a Black Sea coast. If I remember correctly, it was heavily damaged during the 2008 Russian invasion. Would you say that trading through Tbilisi or whatever the name of the port there is would be an option for the Russians if their own Black Sea ports happen to be closed, or it's not possible?
It's much too small is the simple answer. There is a fairly decent sized port and things called Poti. You can go on marine traffic and see that there are some ships there, but the capacity, the size of the port is very small. It's been mostly a container port, but there has been some bulk there, but it's really not very large, or not large enough to move the needle, let's put it that way. In comparison, if you look, I don't have the export figures, but if you look at the export figures in any value, whether it's tons or dollars or tons per day or whatever, from a port like Novorossiysk, it is absolutely huge. Novorossiysk is a refining center for Russia, so where you take crude oil and you refine it into fuel oils and other stuff. It has some of the largest exports of fuel oil in the world. That's where you can buy the cheapest fuel oil. And the fuel oil is what we call the bottom of the barrel. So when you take a barrel of regular oil and you refine it, you get the lighter products, such as gasoline, diesel, jet fuel, naphtha. And then at the bottom, you have stuff like fuel oil. And at the very, very, very bottom, you have tar, which you can just use to, you know, put on roads. But this fuel oil is important because it's been the way that these very large commercial ships have been fueling up. That's their main power source, at least until we find something better and more economical, which at the moment people are talking about either LNG or green ammonia or methanol. There's all kinds of proposals out there, but at the moment fuel oil is what makes the ship sail. So Novorossiysk is extremely important for that. And next to Novorossiysk, which sometimes is put inside of Novorossiysk as well, there is a very important terminal called CPC, which is the Caspian pipeline, where about 1% of the world's shipped oil gets exported from. So if you think 1%, that is a massive amount of oil that comes through CPC. And that is it's the oil that all comes from the Caspian Sea area. Most of it is actually from Kazakhstan. So Novorossiysk is of vital importance for the Russians on that front. And of course, as we discussed, the others like Taman and Kafkaz. If you go on marine traffic, you can see large concentrations of ships around these places of interest. There is a large concentration south of the Kerch Bridge, a smaller concentration on the north of Kerch Bridge, and then you have a concentration around Novorossiysk. We can't understate how important that is for them. And of course, in a perfect world for the Russians, they would be able to retain control of Crimea and the whole of the Azov Sea coast in order to have that that supremacy. And this is also one of the reasons why originally there was a big plan for the Russians to go and take Odessa and places like Chernomorsk, which we can touch on because they're mostly closed. And that's the big difference to our last conversation and this one. But I think you have had a chat with Exit 266 in the past few days about Black Sea developments. So you might have already gone through that.
No, we haven't had the occasion to talk with Exit. She's in demand. What can I tell you? She's very much in demand, and prices have gone up.
That sounds like my every day. Maybe you're just going to have to pay up.
Oh no, we have to pay up. We have to pay up. We negotiate for 15 minutes in when is it? Q3 2024, I think. Something
like that. You will do it just for the paychecks. So, if you look at from the Ukrainian side, last time we spoke, the Black Sea Grain Initiative was still in place. So, there was a safe corridor for commercial bulkers to go to ports, the main ports for this were Odessa, Chernomorsk, Yuzhny, I think, those places too. To load grain, wheat, corn, whatever. We're getting to the corn season at the moment. Then that ended. The Russians put an end to the Black Sea Grain Initiative and started bombing those ports again. So all the mid to larger size bulkers that we talked about, these 45 to 85,000 tons of deadweight ships, are no longer going to those ports. And the Ukrainians have to rely on one side, Romanian friends are helping a lot with Constanța, but on another, of course, the Danube ports, which are quite important, but they're very, very small by comparison. The maximum size of ship that you can bring into the Danube it has to be very small because you only achieve something like 6 or 7 meters of draft. So you typically load ships that are between 7 and 10,000 tons of deadweight or smaller, but mostly even just barges that you barge down the river and you try and load it on a bigger ship down the river. So that's an unfortunate development for Ukrainian grain exports. As summer, we're in peak summer, so to say, but as August ends, the wheat harvest will be coming in. which means that very large quantities of wheat will have to be shipped, and it's going to be somewhat of a headache for the Ukrainians to manage to export all that. There are propositions in place. Of course, as much that can be railed will be railed to places like Poland, exporting a lot through Romania. Romania can be upgraded, so to say, to probably do even a bit more, maybe. And then maybe the utilization in Bulgarian ports, such as Varna and Burgas, can go up. And finally, there is also the Turkish option, bringing stuff in smaller ships to Turkey and then loading bigger ships from there. But also there was a whole conversation about using Croatia ports, which it seems a little bit more far-fetched, but might be possible as well.
I like far-fetched. Okay, got a couple more questions on this subject. But before that, our friend Joseph has raised his hand exactly when we were talking about paying up and paychecks. So I think it has to do with this. Joseph, the mic is yours.
Ben, you owe me money. No, I'm just kidding. Ben, I thought I should mention, and please correct me if I'm mistaken, but of course, we were mentioning the Great Exit 266 and an interview that you did not have with her previously, as in a few days ago. But I wanted to mention, and I'm a little shocked you didn't mention, you will be interviewing Exit 266 on Thursday, the 17th, at this time, like that we're having this interview now. Is that correct, Ben?
Well, I've got Exit looking at me right now through the Canadian winter, so I'll let her make a sign to confirm. I'm very worried I'm on the spot. Yes, it's a yes. So we can tell you that we will have another conversation with Exit next Thursday. Thanks a lot, Miss Exit. So thanks a lot, Joseph. But on that, there's another question coming from another of our very good friends regarding trains. She's not convinced that boats are all that important, and she has a plan to send. She says, "Well, if Novorossiysk ends up being closed, maybe we can just ship all that grain and all that good stuff eastward by train through Kazakhstan, maybe across the Caspian Sea, and is that an option? Or maybe alternatively through the old Silk Road route that goes across Iran and then to the Arabian Gulf."
Yeah, so it's important to have a historical understanding why the old Silk Road existed in the first place. I recommend a book for anybody who wants to read up on this, and it's called A Splendid Exchange: How Trade Shapes the World. And to go in short, in Silk Road times, if you wanted to wear a silk, any garment of silk, you basically needed to be an emperor, because it was so expensive to bring silk over. That problem remains the same. A medium-sized bulker exporting 60,000 tons of grain will probably need a freight train with over 300 rail cars to transport that. So very quickly, you tap out on the maximum capacity of the rail train, which means that, yes, it would be a solution if you had very high-valued commodities. But in a world where everybody's gotten used to something very cheap and in large quantities, you wouldn't be able really fully to accommodate anywhere near the volume that gets shipped. We're talking about, on a yearly basis, 30 million tons of grain or something like that for the Ukrainians. It's a very large quantity that you will not have enough railroads. It is infinitely cheaper to stick things on the boat, and it's beyond belief how cheap it is. You know, once the cargo is on the boat, it'll cost you $30 a ton to bring it to China. If you were trying to rail that, I don't know, you'd be talking probably hundreds of dollars. So there's the price, and then there's the availability, and that availability is not really there. But of course, all the capacity that does exist will be used up to do that, because now that Odessa and Chernomorsk are no longer able to export the cargo, those solutions have to be found. There's another political issue if you do that, is local farmers would experience some form of price dumping on their own cargoes if you bring loads of trains, say, to a place like Poland, and that creates all kinds of reticence from the local governments as well to allow that mass to come through. So I'm not convinced from a capacity perspective, but it will definitely be used up if there is no other viable option.
Fantastic. Well, the thing I really take away from all this, and which is really, really interesting, and I guess really important as well, is when you understand the position of Russia, their access to the world ocean system is through very few and very limited pee holes, basically. And all the rest belongs to either other people or to the landmass.
Being Russia, in short, on the, you know, if you're playing a massive game of Risk, you know, the board game, but in a commercial sense, being Russia sucks. And I think you put it very much correctly. Their geography is some of the worst in the world, which is why traditionally Russia has always sought to expand west, east, south in order to create, find a sort of buffer zone and have better capacity to reach the world with whatever they have. It's kind of funny to think of the world in such primitive terms, but when you think of the Russian mindset, it hasn't actually changed. So that's what it is. The ports in the far east of Russia are basically close to North Korea and Japan. There are places like Vladivostok, which is the very eastern end of Russia, and then some other even crappier places. One is called Nahotka. So that's one place where they can export stuff. But imagine railing all the capacity all the way there. The Trans-Siberian Railway, as much as people love to say how great it is, it's really nothing in comparison to, say, the East-West railways that exist in the United States. It's only impressive by its size, but in terms of cargo carrying capacity, it's pretty small, at least compared to what Russia needs to carry. So that's the Far East covered. It's small capacity, and it requires thousands of kilometers of logistics. And then we already touched on the Baltic ports, which have a problem with freezing up. And also, you know, your neighbors, if you have a port in the Baltic, as Russia, are Estonia and Finland, and you've managed to massively piss those two off. You know, they don't like you for historical reasons either, for pretty good reasons. And then we've already touched on the north, the Barents Sea, White Sea, you know, the extreme north, that's got even more problems of freezing up. So really you're left with one area to reach the world, as we said, the Black Sea. For the Black Sea, you have another choke point, which is Istanbul, the Bosphorus, which makes it very difficult. Russia doesn't have that control. So that is correct. Being Russia is tough. So their answer has been to invade neighbors, which, as I think everybody on this space agrees, is not something that we can agree with.
Of course. And honestly, being Paraguay is tough as well. And since, when was it? The 1860s, they've basically given up on trying to annoy their neighbors. But that is a different story, even though I do enjoy comparing Russia to Paraguay just to piss the Russians. Another person who loves to piss the Russians is Mark.
You got that right, Ben. So, first of all, Freight Monkey, I mean, this is just fascinating listening to your insights. Thank you. It's always good to learn something. And the information you're providing is not something I can go on YouTube and learn about or read a book or scan the newspapers, but it's just fascinating. I don't want to derail the conversation, but I was wondering if there's any direct correlation or indirect correlation with these transport issues of Russia that Freight Monkey has been telling us about, and the Russian economy, especially towards the eye of the falling ruble. If that's beyond the scope of the discussion, I understand, and let's not go there. But I was just kind of curious, and maybe later, Ben, I wanted to know if you'd be willing to discuss this most recent fall of the ruble, and if there's any reason for more encouragement now than there has been in the past year regarding that. Thank you.
You're welcome. I won't be talking about the rubles now because that is not the scope of the conversation, even though you're definitely right. This is something we should touch on. But Freight Monkey, do you want to opine on Mark's question?
Yeah, I can't comment on currencies and all that because it's just too far out of what I'm good at. But I can say this: the whole of the Russian economy. I think someone made a joke about Russia. Some American politician, it might have been under Reagan. Someone said Russia is basically a. Basically a gas station with an army. It's not very far off. The Russian economy is incredibly reliant on their fossil fuels exports. We don't really need to talk about grain because actually comparing the size of their agricultural export economy to their fossil fuels would be a little bit misleading. What really drives the Russian war machine is the various fossil fuels. Russia has excellent reserves of everything that is imaginable in that sphere. Cheap coal, iron ore, all kinds of different metals. More or less rare ones. Stuff like nickel. There's a crazy statistic. I think over 25% of all of the world's nickel, I think, comes from Russia, or some story like that. One town somewhere in the permafrost called Norilsk Nickel, which is a company. The town is called Norilsk. It's known as the most polluted town on Earth. You can watch some videos on YouTube about it. It'll be eye-opening to see the state of life in those places. But beyond that, all those raw materials, but especially oil and gas. And I'll put a very heavy emphasis on oil because essentially gas has been a byproduct of the oil production and was essentially sold off cheaply as a sort of extra incentive for your customer until relatively recently. And the oil was really the profit-making center of that. And all of Russia's oil and gas production and distribution network was geared towards Europe. So talk about a way of shooting yourself in the foot to build, humongous capacity to ship all this to Europe, not necessarily using ships, but also pipelines, as everybody knows a lot now about the pipelines. Go and check a map of Russian pipelines. It's very interesting. Oil, gas pipelines, etc. And now Russia has to find a way to export all this to other places. And it's not as easy because there's no real pipeline capacity in the Far East. There's no pipeline capacity. There is one, but it's not very large into going into sort of Mongolia and China area. For instance, their gas exports have really suffered with that because they don't have the technology or the capital to build up gasification units in places in the Baltic. So all the gas that used to go to Europe via pipeline, maybe not all, but a large amount, just gets burned off, flared. Everybody should be more or less and see what it means. But if you're flaring gas, you're it's a bit like those old pictures or old videos, you know, of an oil rig and the top yellow flame, and that's flaring off the extra gas, and that would just be wasted. And also environmentally stupid because, you know, you're just putting methane into the air without any economic advantage. So that explains a lot of the obsession that Russia has around the Black Sea, protecting one of the few places where they can reach the world.
Fantastic. Thanks a lot. Okay, we don't have a lot of time, and we took a lot longer than I expected, but it was also fascinating. I'd love to use the last 10 or 15 minutes for a conversation, depending on how long you can grant us, to talk about George. You mentioned Turkey. I just wanted to look across the Aegean Sea and ask you about Greece in general, and more precisely about the ship owners. Are they the bad guys? And if so, what do they have to gain? And how have their position evolved over the past year and a half?
I will refrain from calling them the bad guys, because it would be actually a bit unfair to all the bad guys. The Greeks are historically always made their money by sort of doing the spicy trade that no one else necessarily wants to touch or dares to do. And Greece does have a certain cultural affinity with Russia, which, you know, we can't really neglect that aspect of things. But by and large, you know, the ships that have gone into the Dark Fleet and are trading Russia, circumventing sanctions, etc., are less really Greek today than, say, Middle Eastern-controlled in places like Dubai or Indian-owned or Chinese-owned. So calling the Greeks the bad guys is maybe a little bit unfair. But for sure, they've taken advantage, you know, and if you look at the world through the capitalist lens, they should. Where there is a price arbitrage, you know, you should participate and close that arbitrage by providing that service. I think that that, of course, compared to all the other EU G7 countries, the Greeks are maybe the least helpful when it comes to enforcing and trying to create a difficult situation for Russia, but calling them the bad guys might be a little bit unfair. The bad guys, there are many of them, and they're not necessarily even that bad. They just don't really care, or they're more on the pro-Russian end of things, you know. And the people who, in my opinion, are quite bad are the ones operating the Dark Fleet, and are doing things that are outright dangerous and environmentally extremely unfriendly. But those people are controlling their ships from China and the UAE more than Greece. That said, the Greeks are the ones who are the most keen to trade Russia on non-sanctioned cargoes and to take advantage of the higher the premiums. And the premiums have varied a lot over the past year. At the moment, you get about $5,000 to $10,000 a day premium to go to Russia over a non-Russian trade, which is pretty substantial. If your ship owns $30,000 to $40,000 a day, $10,000 extra is pretty nice. But this is not an illegal trade, and if the US wanted to come in and make sure that, say, oil did not move from Novorossiysk They could also say, well, any ship that goes there, you know, goes on the sanctions list. And the US hasn't done that because it's been more politically expedient to let that trade go on. There is this understanding that if you cut off Russian energy exports, you would spike the oil price by so much that it would be counter, it wouldn't work for the US or for Europe. So they've been trying to keep a balance on that. I hope that answers somewhat the question.
Yeah, I guess there's a lot more to it than just a bunch of great guys taking advantage of the situation, even though the fact that they're the one willing to get their hands dirty while the rest is carefully staying away from this should be put at their, should be remembered.
If you want the name of a company that I think is worse than Greek guys, go and look. There's a company called Fractal Shipping. You can Google them. They have been making a lot of money on the back of this situation, and they're based in Geneva. They're not even Greeks. So all I'm saying is I'm all for Greek bashing from time to time, but we shouldn't forget to keep our eyes on all the various people who do this. I personally, from a personal view, I wouldn't engage in Russia. The company I work for, we don't touch at all the Black Sea, and I don't invest in companies that do it. But that's only personal. But as some of my Asian colleagues say, they would say, well, why should we care about Russia, Ukraine? We've got our own problems here. And then you understand that maybe not the whole world thinks, the same way. So that's just an eternal conversation around ethics, I guess.
All right. That one which I'm not ready for at the moment, even though I don't think I agree with you. But that's a completely different problem. One that will be solved one day around a nice glass of grappa. The question I had for you was also, has the Greeks indeed anyone else's relationship with Russia and the Russian trade evolved over the past few months? You mentioned those Fractal guys as well. How are they trading now? Is it different from the way they were trading 6 months ago? I've heard of a shift between renting the boats. I know it's not renting, but I've heard from the move from chartering to outright selling the boats, for instance, as an example of things changing.
So typically Western companies would go and buy a ship from the yard, get the ship delivered, operate the ships for 5 to 15 years. And when she reaches sort of the 15-year age, the ship becomes more expensive to operate and also less desirable and for the sort of A1 counterparties. It's more difficult to go and fix with someone like BP or Shell when you have an old ship. So typically Western companies would sell off their ships when they get to the end of the useful life. And those ships between 15 and 25 years old, depending on the size and what kind of ship, will typically go on and be owned by say a bulk carrier that reaches 20 years old, you sell it to a Chinese owner. And the Chinese owner will trade the ship in China for a bit longer. They'll put a Chinese flag on the ship and they'll do the coastal trade, which pays a bit of a premium. They'll do that very exhausting trade for the ship. It puts a lot of stress on the ship, which is just very short sea trips and putting a lot of cargo on it and going and discharging and basically using it as a sort of back and forth vehicle. And when the ship looks like, she's in terrible condition, they go off and scrap her, which is recycling. The ship becomes essentially razor blades, and then they go and buy another old ship. So selling off the old ships has never been anything special. It's always been done. The big difference is that in the past, since Feb 24, the value of second-hand ships above the age of 15, 20 years old has shot up extraordinarily high, especially when we're talking about tankers. And that has to do with the fact that a lot of owners can't do it themselves, but will sell their ship at a nice premium to what she's actually worth to some, say Chinese owner. And then the Chinese owner will, either keep the ship in okay condition or not, could operate the ship as purely black fleet, dark fleet, and then trade between Russia and China. And because of the economic incentive to circumvent sanctions and because of the money that these ships earn, even if they did only one or two trips, they would be paid off entirely. So that's how the black fleet really came into existence. The way things have changed is, yes, European owners, and this is not only the Greeks, but also A1 listed, top of the range Western owners have been selling off their ships to secondhand owners. It's difficult to control what happens after that. You might sell your ship to, say, Hong Kong Shipping Company, and then the Hong Kong Shipping Company sells the ship directly off to some mafia dude in China, who then decides to put it onto this illegal trade. It's very difficult to control, and that's also one of the reasons why it's so easy to do. Of course, for a very big company, I don't want to name any names, but a very big tanker company, say, that has a ship that reaches the age of 20 years old, they're not really going to be able to do much else with it, because they can't even recycle the ship themselves because they've signed the Hong Kong conventions, which anyway, well, let's not go into that. But it's a little bit difficult to control. But the way that the approach with Russia has changed has been quite simple. At the very beginning of the war, everybody was very afraid. For dry bulk, everything came to a standstill for a while and then slowly picked up again. In Ukraine, because of the Black Sea grain deal, and there were some pretty nice premiums and extra insurance they had to pay, so it was quite profitable to do this trade. And with Russia, at the beginning, there were massive premiums as well, but over the past year, I would say those premiums have dwindled down to close to, no premium at all, just maybe a slight premium per day. And most owners that will accept to do this are privately owned companies. For the tankers, it's been a little bit different, because in the tanker world, you have to be very careful not to circumvent, not to be caught, let's say, sanctions busting. Because the worst thing you can do as an owner is get into the line of line of fire of the DOJ, the Department of Justice. Because if they find out that you've been doing something dodgy, you're screwed. They will go and find you. They will arrest you. They'll put you on the list. You can't, move any money. You can't use US dollars. You don't have access to banking. So no owner wants to be involved in that. So everybody's been extremely careful about what they do if they do trade Russia, or they've been selling off their ships to people who, do not have any legal entity that the Americans can go and touch. For instance, in China, the Indian state-owned ship owner got into some trouble a few months ago because they were listing cargoes in Russia above the price cap, and the Americans went after them, put them on a sanctions list, and then there had to be a negotiation between the Indian government and the U.S. government to basically say, okay, we won't do that again, just please take us off the list because we still need access to our US dollar account. So the response, if you want to summarize it, has been very vast, and it's been all over the place, and it's kind of difficult to answer, but it's certainly been something that I've never seen before in my life.
Just to conclude on this, just to make sure, is there a ghost fleet for the dry bulk? I know there's not actually one, but are the companies trying to create a partition between their clean trade and their Russia trade, which if things go crazy, they could pretend either unload or pretend is different from their regular operations.
Not really. So for the dark fleet in dry bulk, it's not actually necessary because there are very few, if any, sanctions on coal cargoes or grain cargoes. Grain cargoes, not anyway, because any agricultural products have been excluded from any sanctions. But there are also very few sanctions or restrictions on coal or iron ore or steel. So there's not really been the need for a dark fleet because there's been no sanctions to circumvent. One of the biggest industrialists in Russia, a man called Melenchenko, who owns two companies. One is called Eurocamp and the other one is called SUEK. SUEK is the acronym for the Siberian coal company of Russia or something like that. A very large coal exporter. He's still operating entirely legally. Now, because him personally is sanctioned, because he's very close to Vladimir Putin, he basically gave the company to his wife, and she's not sanctioned, and they're operating entirely legally, actually from the UAE, not far from where I am, and they're using US dollar accounts, etc. So there's, for that reason, there's been no need for a dark fleet for them. But on the tanker side, it's a very different story.
Okay. Well, and it is a story that we've covered already in other instances, so we won't get back to this all the more because we are reaching the end of our conversation. I have to say that was great. Some time ago, we were talking and we said, the second interview is always easier than the first one. And I think it really panned out this way. Thank you very much. It wasn't very pleasant in a way, but seeing the world through Russian eyes was really enlightening, both in terms of their motivations and also in a way of, what could really hurt them. So that was all very, very interesting. So for this, I wanted to thank you very kindly. Do you have last parting words before heading into the sunlight in the desert and making millions as you do by benefiting from your immense knowledge on the world of shipping?
I assure you, the millions are yet still working on them. There is an old joke in shipping: is the easiest way to make 100 million is start with 1 billion. If you're interested in investing in shipping, don't use anything that we talked about as sort of a gospel. And do your own research, that's for sure, because it can be a bit of a wonky ride, but it is fun. If you follow me, I do put a lot of also investment advice, but I talk a lot also about Ukraine because it's a subject that's quite close to my heart. But Ben, it was an absolute pleasure. Whenever you want, I'll make sure that I'm always cheaper than AZ-266. I'll charge a lot less. We can talk anytime you need.
Brilliant. Thank you very, very much. Just before saying goodbye, a new friend, Kenzo, is trying to connect. Well, I guess it's too late. We'll send him our very, very best. And I just need to say goodbye to everyone. Thank you again to Freight. Thank you to my friends from Tochny, who paired with me through my technical issues, entirely due to my inability to manage two phones at the same time because, I'm an idiot. And beside that, I wanted to tell you that we will have the pleasure to talk to you again this Sunday for the regular Tochny Weekly. And just, do you know what it is? Is there going to be something special this weekend?
Yep, yeah, and I'm doing my first interview for Tochni on Sunday. Oh man, I am going to be interviewing a fellow, an Australian fellow by the name, man, I'm looking for his name right now, Ben, I'm sorry. But he's a great guy. He works on ambulances. He's in Australia, and they get ambulances, and they work on them, and they show them with medical supplies, and I send them to Ukraine. Yeah, cool guy. The name eludes me. Oh, James Spensley. There it is, Ben. Jeez, I was stalling forever there. James Spensley, yeah. So I'll be interviewing him. I don't know what the military panel guys have cooked up yet, but I'm sure some interesting stuff's going on, of course. Yeah, look forward to it.
Fantastic. Thanks a lot. Sorry, Joseph, for putting you on the spot like this. After this, what is left for me to do is to wish the whole of you a wonderful Friday evening, as well as a great weekend, and see you on Sunday.